I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. This time on Monday, it was just a regular day in Moore, Oklahoma, a suburb of Oklahoma City. But by late the afternoon, a devastating tornado had torn through that community, flattening and tearing apart thousands of buildings and killing 24 people. The photos and videos of the destruction are frankly shocking. It looks like a war zone. It's estimated that the cost of the damages will be well over $1 billion, and this was not the first time that Moore has been hit by a tornado. Well, Philadelphians, like the rest of the country, have been concerned about how residents are coping with the aftermath of the tornado. And joining us is Rachel Hubbard from public radio station KOSU, where she is associate director. And Rachel, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's nice to be here, Marty.
What's the weather today?
Well, it's actually a really bad situation for the residents of Moore because we're having heavy thunderstorms that are not severe, but just a lot of rain. And if you don't have a roof on your house and you're trying to salvage your belongings and you're dealing with flash flooding, it's just a really bad situation.
And where are you today?
I am currently in North Oklahoma City. There's not much happening because of the flash flooding in Moore right now. So we're waiting until a little bit later in the day.
Where are people that have lost their homes? And we're talking about, I'm not sure how many homes, but something like 13,000 structures that were destroyed. Where are these people living?
Well, Oklahoma is a very family-oriented state. And so even after the first night, there were only 100 people in shelters.
Wow.
So that, I think, is a statement to how people take care of each other. Many of them are staying with family or friends. And then other people, I talked to a couple yesterday that the man's employer was putting them in a hotel until they could find an apartment or some other temporary place to live.
And how soon after the tornado hit were you able to go to Moore?
Well, I was doing tornado warnings on the station as the storm developed. And then I got on the road and headed down there. The traffic getting into Moore was horrendous.
Really?
It took us about 2.5 hours to get in because there was no power, so none of the traffic signals were working. People were trying to get in to find their families. Rescue crews were trying to get in. And then there are just curious onlookers. So it was a complete disaster to get into Moore. So I think it was about 3 hours after the tornado when I was finally able to get in.
Well, we've all seen and heard some very moving interviews, and I'm sure you had some yourself, Rachel. What were the questions that you wanted to know from some of the residents?
Well, I was just really following their experiences. And, you know, how do you deal with coming home to your house? And it's overwhelming for me to look at. And it's not my house when the only thing that's left standing in an entire structure is one interior wall. And your neighbor's couch is in your house, and the neighbor's garbage can is in your house, and your stuff is 3 blocks away, if that. And many of these people will probably never find the vast majority of their belongings.
And how have they been coping? I mean, we're several days after the tornado, but nonetheless, there has to be just shock and grief and just sheer amazement that something like this could happen.
Well, not just that, but that it could happen again. Right. Yesterday, I spent the afternoon with a couple who had lost one home in the May 3rd, 1999 F5 tornado that moved through Moore. And they decided that they didn't want to stay in the same place out of fear, so they moved 2 miles south. They lost their house on Monday.
Wow.
So this is the second home that they've lost in Moore in an EF5 tornado. And I asked them, I was like, you know, you guys have done this before. How do you do this? How do you not be overwhelmed? And they used two analogies with me. The husband told me that it's like having surgery. And it's like having surgery for the second time, that you know exactly what's going to happen, you know what the unpleasant parts are going to be, you know where you're going to struggle. But he said that at the end of the surgery, you end up feeling better. And that's not something that I completely understand. That probably has to be something that you would have to go through to understand it. And the wife, the analogy that she used was that it was like losing a family member. And the grief process that you go through in dealing with it. And it's not something that they deal with in a week because they won't have a home for quite some time.
Well, and all of us have seen the images, the video, the photos of the devastation. And, it, you know, it's hard to come up with something that doesn't sound like a cliche. War zone is the one that I use. But as you walk through more, what does it look like to you?
Well, it looks like nothing. It looks like a giant garbage dump in the mud. There are things that just really, when you see the images on television, you don't get the smell and how hard it is to trek through some of these neighborhoods, because this tornado, I don't know exactly how, but it was filled with water, and it basically just ground this water into the soil and the grass. It sucked all the grass off the ground, and so it is this muck that is almost a foot deep, and your feet just sink in it. And so it's there are all sorts of things that make this even more difficult, besides the fact that there's splintered wood, there are nails all over the road. It literally shredded these houses. And there's, you see strange things. Yesterday I walked through a neighborhood and someone's couch was in a tree. Mm. There was a flat screen television sitting neatly on the top of a roof of another house, like someone had placed it there on purpose. So it's just, it's bizarre. But for the most part, it just looks like a trash heap.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like a surreal, almost Dolly-esque kind of landscape if you've got, you know, couches and trees.
Yeah, it's it is the most surreal experience that you can describe. And you have no way to get your bearings as to whether you're facing east or west or anything else. I was trying, this man yesterday was trying to explain to me how to get to his house, because they were already there, and I was let in several hours later. And it was, there are no landmarks.
Hmm.
So, and it's not like the landmarks that there are, he can't exactly say, go to the couch in the tree and turn left, because there are multiple couches in trees.
Wow. We've been focusing on more, and I'm assuming that's where most of the devastation was. But are there other parts of either Oklahoma City or other communities that were affected by this tornado?
Well, that's been an interesting discussion that's been going on in Oklahoma, because there were tornadoes that moved through Oklahoma on Sunday, and there were two other communities that experienced devastating tornadoes on Sunday, and they were both much smaller communities. So now all of this attention has focused on Moore, and the worry is that these two other small communities in the northeastern and further eastern Oklahoma City, those parts of the state are going to be ignored. But the strongest part of the tornado, the most devastation for this tornado, was in Moore. It wasn't on the ground as long as the May 3rd, 1999 tornado.
Mm-hmm.
It was 16 miles, which is a long track for a tornado, but the tornado in 1999, I think, was on the ground for more than 60 miles.
Which is, yes, indeed. The number of dead has been reduced to 24, of course, a tragic loss of life. But I have to say, Rachel, when you look at the devastation, I'm frankly surprised there were not more fatalities or casualties from this tornado.
We were a little surprised, too, just because of the devastation. But the warning, the amount of warning that people had to get out of their cars, to get off the street, to take cover, was pretty significant. The forecasting has increased quite a bit. And for days, they had been telling us that strong tornadoes may develop, and you have no idea where that's going to be, but everyone was really aware. And I think that the people in Moore, some of the people that I had talked to that had gone through both of these tornadoes, they said, you know, I had an uneasy feeling all day.
Oh.
I already had my tornado stuff in the cellar. I knew where my kids were. I left work early because they just had this almost sixth sense that something really terrible was going to happen.
How about social media? Did that play a role
in getting people underground?
Got underground or just alerting people?
Yes, I think that was one of the ways that we were alerting people, besides on our air. And the television forecasters take over the radio airwaves, and because their forecasting abilities are significant in Oklahoma, and they're giving block by block mapping as to where it is, and, you know, if you're above ground, you will not survive. And there were other people that just chose to get their families and get out of town. They literally drove to the south or to the north as fast as they could to get away from this tornado, which is not typically something they recommend.
Right.
But if your choice is to stay above ground in your house or get out of the way, getting out of the way was probably the better choice in this situation.
How many children were killed by this tornado?
Nine children.
Nine children. And were they children at school? Is that where they were killed?
Seven of the children were at Plaza Towers Elementary School. And the other two, one of them was in a 7-Eleven. And I can't remember where the ninth one was, but seven of the children were at school. And the scenes that have emerged from that school are horrific. Teachers were piling students in bathrooms and laying on top of them to try to keep them in the building, because one of the ways that tornadoes kill people is that it literally sucks them out of their location when the roof comes. So the teachers were trying to keep them in the building by all measures possible. And I saw one teacher who had what appears to be the leg of a desk impaled in her leg. The force of this is just, it's truly amazing.
And there were, do you know how many injuries there were as a result of this tornado?
Those numbers are still a little sketchy. 237, I think, was the number that I saw for the number of people who went to the hospital and were admitted. But there were hundreds of other people that received minor injuries that didn't require hospitalization.
And about a minute before I have to say goodbye here, Rachel, but I'm assuming there are FEMA representatives there, Search and Rescue, National Guard. Where does Search and Rescue stand today?
Well, the Search and Rescue portion of this operation is still over. Is already over. People are still trying to find some family members, but they've been accounted for. It's just more people matching up with where they ended up. And it's basically a police state. There's constant helicopters going over to prevent looting, and it requires numerous checkpoints to get into one of those neighborhoods for families that used to live there to go in and try to sift through their belongings.
And I heard that there's the first of several funerals today.
Yes, it will be a tough several days for the community of Moore as they start to bury those children and the other people who were killed. The president is scheduled to be here on Sunday. And then there are other bittersweet sorts of events. The high school graduation is scheduled for Saturday.
Wow. Well, Rachel, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times, and good luck to you and everyone out in the Moore, Oklahoma area. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. That's Rachel Hubbard from public radio station KOSU, where she is associate director. The first of three guests in this hour of Radio Times as we talk about the tornado that hit Moore, Oklahoma. Obviously, the devastation has been all over the news in the last couple of days. We'll be talking about safe rooms and construction after this very short break. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Whether you're gripping a golf club, turning a key, or playing piano, hands make it happen. And when hands need help, St. Mary offers a new way. Appointments with hand specialists available in 2 business days. Fellowship-trained doctors treat hand injuries and chronic conditions, offering advances in therapy, rehabilitation, and minimally invasive surgery. Physician referrals at 215-710-5888 or stmaryhealthcare.org/hand. Supporting WHYY, St. Mary Medical Center in Langhorne. It's your health. Expect more.
I'm Jesse Thorne. You know, disco used to get a lot of guff from both sides. Meathead rockers on one, R&B purists on the other. But for a couple of years in the 70s, disco dominated.
You have this all-inclusive music. Didn't make any difference whether you're white, black, fat, gay. If you had music that kept people on the dance floor, you ruled.
Producer and musician Nile Rodgers on the next Bullseye from NPR.
Tomorrow night at 9 on WHYY.
He's sold millions of records around the world and become a music superstar. Now Pitbull is heading to the big screen. He plays tough guy Toad in the new animation film Epic.
I admire your independent spirit, Nod. I miss that. Feed him to something. Snake would be good.
Pitbull tells us about Epic and his booming music career. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We just got an update on Moore, Oklahoma, devastated by Monday's tornado with KOSU Associate Director Rachel Hubbard. Well, we wanted to know if you could build a home to withstand tornado force winds and flying debris. And joining us now is Bill Colburn. He's a structural engineer with the Applied Technology Council. His first tornado investigation, as it turns out, was in Moore, Oklahoma back in 1999. He's the primary author of the FEMA guide for home builders on safe room construction, and it's called Taking Shelter from the Storm. And Bill Colburn, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. I appreciate you having me on.
Indeed. And to our listeners, any questions or comments you might have about safe construction, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Bill, as I said, your first investigation 14 years ago in 1999 in Moore, Oklahoma. I know you're not in Moore today, but as you look at the images, the video, the photographs of what you've seen, how would you compare and contrast these two tornado effects?
Well, Marty, and the two tornadoes are actually, you know, pretty similar, and we've had an opportunity to overlay the track from Monday's tornado on top of the track that occurred in 1999, and in fact, another one that occurred in 2003. And unfortunately for Moore, those three tracks are incredibly close together. One in 2003 actually paralleled the one in 99, and the one on Monday crossed and ran parallel to part of the one in 99. So the damage is extremely similar. We again, in 99, saw some damage to a major school. Fortunately, in 99, the schools weren't in session like they were in 2013, so we didn't see the same kind of, potential loss of life in a school, but the damage is incredibly similar. And I did an investigation in both Tuscaloosa and Joplin in 2011, and the damage in Moore, you know, is pretty similar to what we saw in 2011 as well.
Well, they do call this part of the country Tornado Alley. I mean, it seems to be a part of the country, even a part of the world where tornadoes are more numerous than other parts of the world.
Yeah, that is for sure. Unfortunately, Tornado Alley is really not an alley. It's a huge blob or, you know, block in the center of the country where tornado occurrences are more frequent than they are in other places, and that large area, you know, extends as far south certainly as Texas and as far east as probably Kentucky, Tennessee, and pretty far west and as far north as Indiana, even Ohio. So it's a pretty large segment of the country where the tornado risk is pretty high.
And I do want to talk with you about safe construction, but we heard from Rachel Hubbard, her description of Moore, where things like the grass was pulled out of the ground. What is, I guess, unique when it comes to a tornado and the kind of destructive force that it has?
Well, there are two primary things, and one is, and what Rachel described, I think, is also true of other vegetation, like trees and whatever, is that the circular winds in a tornado are so strong that they create this huge suction pressure in the center of the vortex of the tornado. So basically, the pressure in that center is so large and negative that it basically pulls up, everything that it's in its path. That suction pressure is a function of obviously how fast the tornado is spinning, and so the slower the spin, the lower the suction force, but the higher the spin, like in an EF4 and 5, right, then the greater the amount of destruction. And so having flipping cars up and landing them in on tops of buildings, and having the grass ripped off the ground and having trees uprooted, those are all signatures of a pretty strong tornado.
We have learned from many of the houses that were destroyed that most of them didn't have basements. Would a basement have helped keep a building intact?
Not necessarily. A basement might have been a safe place to go, but in order to have a basement be a safe place, then one of two things needs to happen. Either there needs to be some sort of enclosure in the basement that's got a strong roof on it as well as walls, and some of those walls could have been the basement walls, so that if the house is still destroyed or something drops on top of the house, those who are in the basement can still be safe. I've seen lots of examples of people who went into basements in other places for safety and then had their house still ripped off of its foundation, and so they ended up not being so safe. So the house needs to definitely be tied down to the foundation in order for it to provide enough protection if you're, you know, taking shelter in the basement.
Can you, though, build a structure, a building, a house that would withstand the kinds of forces that we've been talking about, that would be affordable and might even look nice? It wouldn't look like a fortress, for instance?
Well, there are a couple of options here. And one option that you've alluded to that we haven't quite talked about yet is building a safe room, building a space in an existing building or adjacent to an existing building that is fortified such that it will withstand the kind of wind forces that we see in tornadoes, as well as all the windborne debris that occurs. And those safe rooms, of which there are thousands around the country now, have in fact and do in fact provide protection for people. I think I heard yesterday that there were as many as 60 or 70 safe rooms in Moore along the track of this tornado. So I'm going to be extremely interested, as I'm sure others are going to be, in how those safe rooms performed and how people who were in them, you know, made out. But we have lots of evidence that those safe rooms in fact save lives. And those rooms are really nothing more frequently than the size of a closet or a laundry room or some, you know, space like that in an existing building. The second thing that we do find out, and I would suspect that we would find it out from this tornado as well, is that while the winds are the very highest and cause a lot of damage in some parts of the city of Moore, there's a huge area that was affected by the tornado where those wind speeds are not that high, where I would expect to see wind speeds that are more similar to what we see in hurricanes. And I think we know a fair amount about how to design buildings to resist hurricane force winds. So I think there are opportunities, certainly in the rebuilding effort, to use some of the techniques that we know work in hurricane-prone regions to at least be able to reduce the damage that occurs to people's property and potentially would keep them safe if they were inside as well.
And this
the safest thing to do is to have a safe room.
Is to have and is that sort of like the bomb shelters that I remember from the 1950s?
Well, they frequently can be similar to that. I mean, they do have to be pretty robust. I mean, if you have an EF4 or 5 tornado with wind speeds that approach or exceed 200 miles an hour, we've seen some incredible debris from tornadoes. But that 200-mile-an-hour wind could propel a 2x4, you know, a piece of wood stud that's in a residential wall as fast as 100 miles an hour. And so in order to have that be resisted, then those walls need to be reinforced concrete or reinforced masonry or multiple layers of plywood, maybe even with a sheet of steel on the outside of it. They need to be pretty robust. And the doors to those spaces need to be pretty robust so that the doors don't get sucked off of the shelter. But that's all doable, particularly if it's, you know, a small space and it's in the interior of your house or interior of a garage, kinds of places.
Well, let me just quickly reintroduce you, and that's Bill Colburn. He's a structural engineer with the Applied Technology Council, and he's also the primary author of the FEMA Guide for Home Builders on Safe Room Construction, that guide called Taking Shelter from the Storm, and we called him up to talk about the tornado in Oklahoma, and interestingly enough, his first tornado investigation was Moore, Oklahoma, back in 1999. Any questions or comments that you might have for our guests, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Bill, you mentioned that we have learned from hurricanes how to build more sound and, I guess, safe structures. Can you just go over that, what that includes, so our listeners understand?
Sure. The primary thing is to be able to keep the building together, which is kind of an obvious statement. But in order to be able to do that, you really have to follow the way the building is put together from the top of the roof all the way down to the foundation and make sure that it will stay together. Mm-hmm. So the techniques that we use in hurricane-prone regions are mechanical connectors, straps, or hurricane ties, we call them, to tie the roof down to the walls. We have to make sure that where there are openings in the walls, like where windows and doors are, that we have straps around those openings so that we don't lose part of the roof or the wall area above those windows and doors. And we have to follow that load path all the way down to the foundation and make sure it's attached soundly and strongly to a foundation. So typically that means bolting it to a masonry foundation or a concrete slab or a concrete wall. And usually it will mean that walls will have to be potentially reinforced so that instead of 2x4s, you might need 2x6s, mm-hmm. or you might need them spaced closer together. Or certainly if you have a masonry wall, you need to have reinforcing steel and concrete in it. So you can still build a pretty attractive building, certainly a residence, that is hurricane resistant because all these things that I've just described are all hidden behind the walls or in the roof.
Have you found, and I don't know whether this is something you have investigated, but after some of these tornadoes, whether Joplin or even more back in 1999, are people taking your advice, the advice of FEMA, about how to create these safer, stronger structures, or do people essentially rebuild what they already had?
That's a great question. The safe room concept, and FEMA has a grant program to actually help fund safe rooms and residences and community shelters in communities, started in after the 1999 tornado as a program. That's when this Taking Shelter from a Storm safe room document was written. It's when community shelter design guidance was written, and it's when they started the grant program. So the answer is yes. I guess from my standpoint, I'd like to see more people take advantage of it. But people are, sort of getting the message that they really do need to do something a little extraordinary and go above and beyond certainly what's required in the building code to provide themselves with a safe space. So they are taking advantage of it. And I think the 60 or 70 safe rooms that I mentioned were actually installed along just the track of the Monday tornado is kind of a testament to that. You know, there are some people, you know, getting the message and doing it. There aren't very many building stronger houses without safe rooms, so I don't know that there are many examples of people using hurricane-resistant construction techniques to just provide themselves with a safer building. I've heard of some builders in some areas and some in Oklahoma for sure that are, you know, have programs for homeowners where they're encouraging people to build above the minimum building code requirements, and so I think those are all good things. Hopefully this event will cause more people to think about doing the same sort of thing.
I'd be curious what you make about what happened in one or two of the schools in Moore, which was that the children, the students, were told by their teachers to go into the hallway, to go into bathroom, to get out, I guess, of their classrooms as a safety measure. Was that the right thing to do?
Well, I'm not sure what else they would have told them to do. I'm not sure what else they could have done. I certainly haven't seen the schools, so I don't know, you know, if there had been any, if there were any other options. But I know even when I was a kid, I mean, that's what we were all told to do. Those were the safest places, we thought, and certainly the corridors and bathrooms would get people away from windows, which, you know, a lot of damage and certainly a lot of injuries and or potential deaths can be caused by all the glazing that gets broken. So broken glass is, you know, certainly a bad thing in a classroom, and so the corridors would have provided protection from broken glass if that's all that was to happen. But unfortunately, with these high wind events, what frequently happens and what sounds like it happened in Plaza Towers and the other elementary school.
Yeah.
Is that the roof lifted off, which it frequently does in these very high winds, and the corridor walls are not tied to the roofs. They're never really intended to take any load from the roof. And so the roof lifts up and the walls collapse, and unfortunately, if there are people in the corridors, those walls collapse on top of them.
Mm. Frightening.
Yeah, it is frightening. And it's one of those places where we have just not been able to spend much engineering energy looking for retrofit solutions, but I'm pretty convinced after this one that we need to focus some time and energy and resources on looking for ways to retrofit some of these buildings. I mean, we have a whole lot more older schools than we will ever have new ones, and while we might be able to do something in a new school with reinforcing or hardening those corridors or putting in safe rooms or whatever, we've got a whole lot of schools built in the post-World War II era that are probably similar to Plaza Towers that I think we really need to focus some energy on.
I'm thinking about people living in trailers or even just trailers in the path of a tornado. Are they one of the most vulnerable structures just because they're a trailer?
They really are. And with tornado wind speeds, I honestly don't know of any way to keep them either tied down or together.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly the ones that are built and delivered to the center of the country aren't really designed for very high winds. I mean, those that are delivered along hurricane coastlines, at least in the last, 15 or 20 years maybe, have started to have some increased wind resistance built into the box, if you will, into the structure. But you still have to secure them to the ground, and so even a stronger box, if it's not secured to the ground, is still going to roll over and or crumple. And so those structures really are the most vulnerable, and people who live in them, really, they only have two choices. One is to get out and leave if they can. The other would be for park owners to install some sort of community safe room so that everybody who lived in that particular park could at least have some place to get to from a tornado, within a run or a quick walk, within 5 or 10 minutes. So, and we've seen a few of those developed over the country, around the country.
And we have to say goodbye to you in about 45 seconds or so. But to underscore the importance of early warnings, or as Rachel Hubbard was telling us, the use of social media, I'm assuming that, the sooner you know a tornado is coming, the better off you're going to be.
Oh, absolutely. And the distance that you have to get to a shelter, is really a reflection of how much warning time you have. So the more warning time you have, the better chances you have of either making it to a safe place or getting out of harm's way, as Rachel described to people driving north and south out of Moore. So it's absolutely crucial. And the Weather Service is doing a terrific job these days of providing increased warning times, which is real important.
Well, Bill Colburn, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. He's structural engineer for the Applied Technology Council, primary author of the FEMA Guide for Home Builders on Safe Room Construction, that guide called Taking Shelter from the Storm. We'll be talking about search and rescue after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Bristol Riverside Theater supports WHYY and presents Inherit the Wind by Jerome Lawrence and Robert E. Lee. Now through June 9th, two lawyers face off in this courtroom drama that has been hailed as an American classic. The accused, a science teacher, is crime teaching evolution. This production has audiences on the edge of their seats. Tickets at 215-785-0100 or brtstage.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Julianne Moore. She plays an out-of-control rock star and mother in the midst of a custody battle in the new present-day film adaptation of What Maisie Knew. One of her co-stars is a 6-year-old girl.
I'd say, listen, I'm going to yell in this scene. I just want you to know, I'll be like, I'll talk like this, and then I'm going to yell really loud, so don't be scared.
Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. During that hearing into the IRS targeting of conservative groups, a top agency official invoked the Fifth and refused to answer questions. So who knew what when at the White House? Also, a startup wants to replace those foam peanuts you use in packing with mushrooms. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We've been talking about Monday's tornado in Oklahoma. We got an update from Rachel Hubbard from the public radio station KOSU. We just said goodbye to structural engineer William Colburn. He was discussing safe shelter construction. And joining us now is David Martin. He's director of the Rescue Training Program at the Emergency Services Training Institute, and that's at Texas A&M Extension Service. He's also a member of the Texas Task Force One Urban Search and Rescue. And David Martin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much, Marty. Appreciate being invited on your show.
Absolutely. And to our listeners, any questions or comments, we're talking about search and rescue. Do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. David, how many members of your team are in Oklahoma?
We have Type 1 task force up there that's a 83-member team.
And who's part of that team? Who are what kind of skills and skill sets do these team members have?
Well, you know, that's what's really unique about this level of response. An urban search and rescue task force brings together a number of disciplines. They're self-sustained. They can operate in austere environments. But you'll have everything from people who specialize in technical search and the utilization of technology to try to locate victims and the utilization of specially trained search dogs to locate victims. And you'll then again have hazmat specialists, because in this type of situation, vehicles carrying chemicals or chemicals stored in businesses or in homes may have spilled. You'll have technical rescue specialists who've been specially trained on how to shore up a building or how to breach and break concrete or cut through steel to try to get to the victims. And then you'll have disaster medical specialists, physicians and medics, who have been specially trained on how to go down into a very tight and austere environment of a collapsed structure and initiate therapy and life-saving care to someone who may remain trapped for a number of hours during the extrication process. There's also support for the task force that includes the logistics and the communications and every component that would be necessary for these task forces to operate in an environment that's lost all of its infrastructure. So that's what's really unique about the type of capability that an urban search and rescue task force brings to an incident like this.
And how soon were you able to get your team into Oklahoma?
The team was called up the evening that the storm had hit. They assembled and got their equipment together. There's a lot of equipment that goes. These are convoys of trucks that transport the equipment and the personnel. And they arrived in Oklahoma City at about 7 o'clock the next morning and immediately went to work in searching the areas and more and continued that work the entire first day. I think the first day of operation, they were able to clear 376 structures. So that was pretty considerable amount of work being done in a very short period of time.
And that certainly is. And I'm assuming working with first responders, local people that were on the scene shortly after the tornado hit?
That's exactly right. You know, most victims are rescued in the first few hours by just whoever's nearby. And we've seen that from this incident as well. It's the neighbor, it's the passerby, it's another family member. And then the second level of response are going to be the trained first responders. And they bring some rescue tools, and, of course, they have some expertise, and they're able to affect rescues in a little bit more difficult situation. Their search capabilities may be not as good as you would see in an urban search and rescue task force. But, again, the highest level would be once you've brought in urban search and rescue teams and task forces who are specially trained in the techniques to locate the victims. And that, of course, is one of the bigger challenges. Once you've been able to rescue those that are obviously in distress, can call out, finding those that are buried under debris fields is much more challenging.
And I'm assuming there's listening technology you can use for those kinds of circumstances?
That's exactly right. You know, the tools that the search specialist will use really involve technology in the form of search cameras that can look down into the rubble pile, audio detection capabilities. We saw these being utilized in Haiti and in other collapse zones where they're able to use very sensitive equipment that not only detect even the most minute movement or breathing of a victim that's trapped, but helps triangulate exactly where in that rubble pile that victim is going to be. And then the other tool they use, which I have to say is my favorite, are the search dogs.
I just scribbled the word dogs down, but no, please go ahead, David Martin.
Well, you know, that's looked upon as a tool, and the reason is the dog can provide you with a lot of information very, very quickly. And in fact, there's no other tool available to the search specialist that works as quickly and as efficiently as the search dog. And it really is amazing to watch, in that if you and I and a group of other people are standing on a rubble pile, the dog is able through scent recognition to immediately figure out that we're all here, and he knows our scent, and what he knows he's looking for is the scent of that person still alive who he can't account for.
Wow.
And so they are really amazing in that they are able to do that very quickly, and that's essential in a scene like we saw in Moore, because you've got to very quickly go through these debris fields and figure out where you have victims. The dogs are a critical part of that process.
And I'm assuming also finding dead bodies as well.
Yes. Now,
sadly,
the dogs that are utilized initially by urban search and rescue task forces are trained to find only those people who are alive. And they are trained to look for that scent. We have other dogs that are human remains dogs that are brought in later to look for human remains. And it's important to understand that those require separately trained animals so that they know exactly what it is they've been trained to look for.
Are there kinds of, I'm thinking about even the stresses on dogs, but also the stresses on the people who are doing this kind of search and rescue work, knowing how much devastation, knowing that they will probably come across something that they would not want to see?
Well, that's one of the things that is most difficult, because in many instances, even those first responders who've had some training and some experience and have seen things like car accidents or other types of traumatic injury really aren't prepared for the scope of devastation and the numbers of injuries and type of injuries that they see in this particular situation. And so it's always important after an event like this that there's some debriefing that takes place, that critical incident stress management is brought into play to help these people cope with these problems. Because the typical first responder is going to try to wall that off and not process any of that so that he's capable to continue to do his job. But at some point in time, he is going to have to face that and to process that, and oftentimes we'll need some help doing that.
And that's David Martin. We're talking about search and rescue, something that has been going on in Oklahoma after the devastation of the tornado, which blew into Moore, Oklahoma, on Monday afternoon. Any questions or comments? Again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. David, and we've all seen the images of these flattened buildings, and I'm wondering for your team, what the process is of going through the debris of a building, what you're looking for, whether it's toxic materials or whether it's dangerous structures. If you can just sort of take apart what it is that your team does when you're going through a building.
Certainly. You know, when the task force first arrives, they get as much as intelligence from the local responders and the people that live in that community as possible to help identify where there may be life that is trapped and they need to focus on that, or there may be hazardous issues that need to be addressed. So once they've gained that intelligence, they also do a quick reconnaissance. And the point of that is that you might come upon a structure that was a house, and there's someone telling you they think someone's inside, and you commit your resources to try to do something at that location, not aware of the fact that two blocks away is a school that's collapsed or a nursing home. So that's why it's imperative that initially you have better situational awareness through reconnaissance. And so you send your teams out very quickly just to make a detailed sketch of what's out there and where we need to focus our attention first. So that's the first part of the process. And then they start the actual search, again, utilizing the dogs to quickly go through these debris fields. And one of the things that's an important consideration is you may have heard the accounts of that the ambulances and the first responders couldn't get in to these locations because there was debris in the roadway. Well, before you move that debris with machinery, you need to make sure that there's not a victim in there to be rescued. The other thing that is a real challenge is that the landmarks are gone. And so someone may say, you need to go search First and Main Street, and you're not able to determine where First and Main Street is. And so we utilize GPS technology and mapping technology that helps us identify through other means where those locations are. And as they go through doing this technical search, they document through that technology exactly where the structure was that they searched, what they found or did not find there, and then they move on so that we have a record of showing what's been searched and who was found where.
And when is your work done?
Well, the work is done when you've cleared all the structures you've been assigned to search, and also in that process extricated anybody that's there to be rescued. Certainly, if you come upon those who are deceased, that is noted, and the process that then begins after the rescue process of securing them and removing them from that scene.
Do you think, and it looks like most people have been accounted for, and there are 24 people that died in Moore on Monday. Do you think there's any chance that someone is still alive?
You know, you hate to say that there isn't any chance. One of the things that's different from what we've seen, like the scene just a week ago in Bangladesh and the building collapse, and
yes,
what we've seen in scenes of people being found days and weeks later in rubble piles at earthquakes, is the type of structures that were affected here. They were not huge masonry structures that collapsed in such a way that voids were created and people could survive in those voids. So it's, in that regard, it's much easier to search and to locate where the victims are. Is there a possibility that someone is still under some debris in a storm shelter and they haven't been located? Yeah, that possibility exists, but the teams have been reporting back to us that they are now searching the same areas a third time. And so I think that there's a very, very small chance that you would find any live victims this far into the incident.
I read, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that the task force was formed after the 1995 bombing of the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City nearby. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. The whole discipline and the whole concept of urban search and rescue really was born out of the earthquakes that occurred in the Bay Area in the late 80s. But was still really in its infancy in the early 90s. FEMA had already begun its urban search and rescue program. But Texas Task Force 1 really didn't become developed until after the attack on the Murrah Federal Building.
And I know that you obviously investigated that. We've been talking about the tornado in Moore, Oklahoma, and you've looked at hurricanes, Hurricane Katrina, and other hurricanes as well. Also, a crash site at an airport. I'm assuming each of these sites is unique.
It is, and I'd have to say, you know, where you're in a scene like, let's say, the crash site at DFW Airport on August 31st of 1988, you know that you have a lot of resources and infrastructure still in place. There are still hospitals. There are still communications. You can call in more resources. I think what's really unique about situations like Moore and Katrina was the first example we got of this, is that you can have an event that occurs that destroys that infrastructure, and you don't have a nearby hospital anymore to go to, and you don't have the ability to communicate by radio or cell phone. And those become real challenges that you have to make sure that you've addressed before the next incident. So, yes, each one of those incidents is unique. And if there's something good that can be brought out of that is that from those lessons, you develop a plan to handle the next situation.
And why do you do this work, David?
I do this work because I love it. You know, it is a very rewarding work. We're training responders from all over the world, from other countries that come here to Disaster City. And it's a unique facility, and so it really enables us to take a look at emerging technologies that may make search go more quickly in the future. Use of robotics is one of those. And it also helps us learn from other responders in other countries technologies or practices they're using that may make us better at what we do here in this country.
And we're almost out of time here. When do you expect then your team to come back from Moore, Oklahoma?
They were demobilized this morning at 8 o'clock. They should be on the road, and they should be back in College Station, their headquarters, at around 3 or 4 this afternoon.
So their job will be done?
Their job will be done.
Well, David Martin, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And he's director of the Rescue Training Program. That's at the Emergency Services Training Institute, and that's at Texas A&M Extension Service. He's also a member of the Texas Task Force 1 Urban Search and Rescue, talking about the work that the team has been doing in Moore, Oklahoma. We also talked with Bill Colburn. He's a structural engineer, and we began with Rachel Hubbard, associate director at KOSU, the public radio station in Oklahoma. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us. Stay with us for Hour 2.